Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. It's been a busy week for the Institute. This is our third function in 2 days, but it's great to have Morris Newman here, who I'll introduce very briefly. I asked Mr. Newman to speak for us quite some months ago, I think around May or June, and he agreed to come in this time in October, and he's been in our program for a while, and he's very welcome. Mr. Newman is well known, but I'll introduce him briefly. Morris Newman has been involved in banking for virtually all his business career. He was on the board of the Australian Stock Exchange from 1990 and chairman of the Australian Stock Exchange between 1994 and 2008. And of course, he's had many, many public roles in Australia over the years. But these days, he's best known probably for being chairman of the ABC, a position which he's held since 2007 and which he will hold until around the end of this year. Morris Newman's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on pluralist, partisans and public discourse. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. And good evening, everybody. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I have to say that the Sydney Institute, I think, Jared, is an appropriate place for me to speak, because it's been dedicated for so long to the contest of ideas, and to talk about pluralist partisans and public discourse, I can think of no better place. And nights like this are, after all, a genuine effort in the pluralist pursuit. Hard to say pluralist, but I'll get the hang of it by the end of the night. But I want to applaud you, Jared and Anne, for your dedication to the cause. I thought too that as both a convergence review and an independent media inquiry are now underway, it was quite a good time to consider and discuss what we want and expect of our journalism and our media. And if we think we're overdoing it a bit with a media inquiry, spare a thought for the British who, in the wake of that phenomenal backlash against the News of the World, have launched 14 different inquiries. Now, these are questions, there are questions that are bound to be asked during the Australian media inquiry, and I've been asking some of those questions myself. What is the best way for the media to serve the public? What's the ideal contribution that it can make to civic life, particularly in an age of increasingly intense polarisation? I preface my responses to these questions with a disclaimer. My interest is in the wider media sector, which includes the ABC, of course, but it's the role of the public media in the public discourse. And I draw on my time at the ABC, both as a board member and as chairman, but I've also had 5 decades of experience as a businessman and, of course, as a media consumer. My concern, as always, is for the bigger picture. Commercial media are, in order to differentiate themselves from a crowded market, able to go down a road which is of greater partisanship, particularly so in the current highly charged climate. And that's a legitimate direction, but it's commercially risky for large media groups, which may end up with a smaller yet more committed audience. For their unaligned consumers, the search for pluralism will not be in the same convenient place. Fox has certainly shown that it can be a great success in filling a gap in the market, that as a business model, this business strategy has much to recommend it. Research by SNL Kagan suggests that last year Fox made a profit of over $800 million, which significantly was more than the combined profits of the 2 biggest competitors, CNN and MSNBC. But unmet demand in the market to which Fox is dedicated may not suit every editorial taste. Public broadcasters, on the other hand, are not obliged to produce a profit and do not and should not have any similar liberty to the commercial media in imposing limitations on points of view. When polarisation and partisanship are all around in bloom, the only responsible course for the public broadcaster is the pluralist path. And I understand perfectly well that one person's pluralism is another person's bias. And I'm sure whether there's even a consensus, I'm not sure whether there's even a consensus on bias or how useful it might be. The Australian noted in a recent editorial, and I quote, "The reality is that claims of bias are often simple, crude attempts to intimidate journalists and editors," end of quote. I understand, too, the contemporary disdain for impartiality and objectivity, that many media academics insist these are simply impossible to achieve. I also appreciate only too well the allure of the catchphrases that you find in discussions about journalistic practice now, such as "transparency is the new objectivity," first brought to my attention by New York University professor of journalism, Jay Rosen, during his visit to Australia last year. I get all that. Yet I'm also the chairman of an organisation whose responsibilities are bound by statute. And the ABC Act of 1983 is pretty clear on the subject of impartiality. It sets out duties of the board, which include, and I quote, "the duty to maintain the independence and integrity of the corporation, the duty to ensure that the gathering and presentation by the corporation of news and information is accurate and impartial, according to the recognised standards of objective journalism, and the duty to develop codes of practice relating to programming matters." So while transparency may be the new objectivity, the ABC must go on trying to live up to the old objectivity and the impartiality each day. Unless that is, if community standards and expectations of us change, we can observe just how much community thinking has changed and how the ABC has responded. And we can do that by looking at history, by looking at the time when ABC television journalism was in fact in its infancy, in the late 1950s. Neville Peterson was a program maker and journalist at the ABC, who worked there for a quarter of a century until 1978, when he became an academic. One of his pieces of published research is a monograph, "Whose News? Organisational Conflict in the ABC, 1947-1999. In this, he set out the ethos of ABC News and the view of journalistic responsibility that prevailed within the ABC at that time. Peterson writes that the ABC's published professional code reinforced the role of the ABC's news in legitimating authority and supporting established values and sanctions of society. Crime was downplayed. Divorce, rape and antisocial aspects of community life were ignored. There was to be no criticism of the police. News of strikes was deliberately limited to state news for fear that it might spread. Reporters were warned not to take questioning of the facts in handouts from politicians beyond their proper limits." Now, while I often prefer tradition to innovation, I have no yearning for the vanished world of the old ABC journalism, or for that matter, its values. And it's difficult to think of any liberal democracy today where the media could be so described. The set of values was displaced, so many of its certainties and assumptions upended by a series of events through the 60s, culminating in Watergate, where those in power were repeatedly found to be untrustworthy and unworthy of their office. Trust matters, but it matters not just for institutions and people in power. It matters too in journalism that is supposed to hold that power to account. And it seems to me that journalism today, and the fewer and fewer media organisations that are there, which currently provide it, show great vulnerability on two fronts: a financial one, and another, I think, is of far greater importance, a vulnerability in trust, in authority, in credibility, all of which makes all of which may create a crisis in legitimacy. Our institutions have lost the trust of the people. If there is a single thing going on in the world today, from the Middle East to New York to Greece, it is a loss of trust in our institutions, especially government and regulatory institutions, and the press deserves a lot of that loss of trust. We have to ask ourselves why in this current culture people are seeking information not to be more illuminated, but rather seeking information to reinforce already held ideological and political beliefs. That is where our journalism is headed as well. Now, it may surprise you to know that those are not my words. They were heard just last month at a debate hosted by The Guardian entitled, After Hacking, How Can the Press Restore Trust? And they were spoken by the journalist and author Carl Bernstein, co-winner of the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on Watergate, reporting whose impact on American public life and the culture of journalism itself has been immense. In December, I will have all but completed my five-year term as chairman of the ABC. And as I look back over that time, I would have to say that I'm pleased with our progress. We've added two television channels, launched digital radio, commissioned an exciting drama slate, introduced cutting-edge technology which allows more people to connect with us in more ways more often. We've opened up fresh opportunities for people in country areas to engage with us, and we are better funded. We've improved our work practices so that we work smarter and deliver better value for the money which our taxpayers fund us with. I believe morale amongst staff is higher now than when I started, and we have enlarged our footprint, both physically and metaphorically. Arguably, in many ways, the ABC has become a media leader, and our managing director, Mark Scott, has been recognised both domestically and internationally for his ideas and contributions to broadcasting, and he will continue with us for some time to come. Now, it would be tempting of me to claim much of the credit for these positive developments. Tempting, perhaps, but untrue. It's not me, but our people who must take the credit for those achievements. Yes, the board directors and I have, when required, I think pulled the right rein. But judgment is the hallmark of good boards, and I've been supported during my tenure by excellent directors. But despite these advances, some of the same vulnerabilities that concerned me when I took up my position as chairman 5 years ago remain. They are vulnerabilities which go hand in hand with being a public institution in which the public places its trust. As a taxpayer-funded organisation, our performance attracts attention, much of it positive, but some stridently critical. At one level, this can be satisfying because it's a testament to the ABC's relevance to public life. I mean, who would bother arguing, after all, over the ABC if it didn't command some sort of attention and respect? Being admired for achievements even by detractors can be good for the soul and good for our image. Unfortunately, some of our critics see our success as coming at their expense. And whether it is an argument that has validity or not, we can certainly expect them to make us an ongoing target, particularly in a tough business environment, where some of the private media organisations are seeking to erect paywalls around their content. And while the ABC provides quality content and services free, I have to say that paywalls might also be an attractive option for us, except that that would be asking taxpayers to pay twice for what it is we broadcast. So in this climate, we must ensure our own track record is exemplary and thereby minimise the opportunity for attack. This means being efficient and scrupulously faithful to our charter in every way that we can. And should we deviate from that, we have to expect criticism to surely follow. Freedom of expression is a precious gift, most valued when it ceases to exist. Yet I observe an unhealthy tendency in politics and society generally today to, under certain circumstances, tolerate its abrogation. There is a growing chorus of voices which are directed to shutting down certain narratives. Too often, who says what is more important than what is said? We are being coerced into yielding to self-appointed authority and into accepting without question dubious propositions that support just one side of the argument. Ad hominem attacks substitute for logical and evidence-based discourse that would otherwise allow viewers and listeners the opportunity to decide for themselves where they stand on certain issues. Last year in Beijing, I attended an international conference on the topic of freedom of the press. Media representatives from around the world were asked to raise their hand as to whether the Prophet Muhammad should be treated differently to any other subject. On a show of hands, a clear majority voted him off limits. Now, if the Prophet is a no-go area, who or what else should be quarantined? I'm sure many will have their favourites with sound reasons advanced as to why this is best for us. However, like forbidden fruit, censorship heightens the appetite for what is kept from view and gives added force to rumour, speculation and untested assumption. However, inevitably in any push for silence, there will be an inherent conflict between the public's right to know and the individual's right to privacy. There is strong support for WikiLeaks, freedom of information and Australia's right to know, because we believe sunlight is the best disinfectant. Yet at the same time, we are repelled by the news of the world and its release of intensely private information. No one, I believe, has the nerve to describe this activity as being in the public interest, but they were able to point to other forces at play. Who was buying the papers after all? The sincerity of Britain's fit of morality about phone hacking is open to doubt because the News of the World did not become the country's most successful paper by chance, Nick Cohen wrote in The Observer. It succeeded by using the techniques of the Peeping Tom and the blackmailer to present a theatre of cruelty to 7 million readers who were more than happy to read on. Now, WikiLeaks comes by information improperly. Woodward and Bernstein illegally access records for their Watergate investigation, just as the News of the World did. All could be said to have accessed information and data via criminal means. Yet newspapers are, rightly or wrongly, seen as gatekeepers, where higher ethical standards should apply. They are meant to play by different rules and to observe codes of behaviour not expected of WikiLeaks. It is therefore important not to conflate the News of the World actions with those of WikiLeaks. As Nicholas Lemon, Dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, has noted, WikiLeaks generated significant information about how political, diplomatic and military institutions function in ways that can lead to an enriched democracy. Millie Dowler's voicemail messages did not. News of the World's right to know did not pass the public benefit test, and this is a troubling yet vital distinction. That said, I am in favour of sunlight. Emails should be written as if they will be discovered. Ministers and diplomats should speak as consenting adults, as if they are on the record, even if discussions are in private. Care should be taken where matters of national security or other matters of important national interest are concerned, to be deliberative and careful about what, where and to whom things are said. The same goes for boards and management. Of course, there is so much information which is strictly private and confidential. But we have enough examples in these days of the internet and electronic theft to know that we must take responsibility for minimising the fallout from unwanted disclosure. The ABC's Jonathan Holmes wrote a piece for The Drum earlier this year in which he said, quote, "Strange though it may seem, a lot of journalists get into the business for the same reason that a lot of politicians do. They want to change the world." Holmes went on, "If people can be told the truth, they reckon the world will be a different place. Anyone who looks back over the last 50 years of Four Corners, as I have since we celebrated his birthday recently, would see the connection between the reporting done by the program and the way we've grown as a nation, how journalism has led to changes in public policy, the law, and history. Information has a habit of doing that. We see that what we're doing wrong and we try to improve ourselves." Jonathan Holmes asserts and makes that making the world a different place is the goal that drives Julian Assange. Well, he may well be right. However, if journalists are given unrestricted license by their employers to propagate a selective truth to change the world to their thinking, it is possible neither the public nor the media will be well served. Unlike elected representatives, it is difficult to hold journalists to account, and they, no matter their conviction, have no monopoly of wisdom. At the News of the World, it appears license was granted, and a whatever-it-takes culture evolved into an attitude in news-gathering which encouraged unscrupulous practices and the development of relationships between journalists, the police and politicians, in which the power of the press, essentially in a free society, was misused and abused. Such arrangements imply patronage and reciprocity, which, regardless of legality, can be extremely corrosive to the democratic process, and it is certainly not in the public interest, nor is it in to the public benefit. So the important takeout for the Australian media is not that phone hacking is wrong. While that has been very much the focus, we don't need to see people going to prison or 16 former staff and 2 former editors arrested to learn that lesson. What we must do is ensure that the Fleet Street culture does not infect our own media corps. Given Australia's relative informality, the comparative isolation of Canberra, and the closed confines of Parliament House, it is indeed a risk. The Canberra hothouse and the 24-hour news cycle are conducive to a cosy relationship where shared assumptions can flourish and where the public communications channels can carry dictation rather than critical analysis. It is where the truth is always in danger, and where, if the media is to be put under the microscope, scrutiny should be applied. "Look back over the past decade," says John Camphor, chief editor of the Index of Censorship, "to the road to war in Iraq, to the behaviour of bankers and more, and ask yourself, have journalists found out too much about the activities of those with power, or too little? Open any newspaper and search hard for unvarnished and unspun insights. During a decade in the Westminster lobby, I saw more stenography than journalism. It is too weak, not too strong." Trust is always and everywhere an essential ingredient in respect, and there is growing evidence that the public's trust in the media is declining. Carl Bernstein may have been speaking just last month about this loss of trust, but polling in the United States by organisations like the Pew Research Centre and in the UK by BBC Reuters have been telling us that story for years. The most recent Gallup poll, the annual update on trust in mass media, finds American views entrenched, with 57% expressing little or no trust in the media to report the news fully, accurately and fairly, and 63% perceiving bias in one direction or another. A recent poll by Essential Media Research in Australia confirms a similar fall in Australia. With the exception of the ABC, which lifted its score and is the most trusted source, trust overall dropped. The biggest drop was for commercial television news and current affairs, which fell from 64% to 49%, while commercial talkback radio also suffered a sizeable decline. What we should ask are the consequences when there is a public perception that our media are becoming an increasingly unreliable reference point. When people then turn to the internet, is it for information or confirmation, as Bernstein has suggested, or just something more dependable? It appears that people are increasingly prepared to back their own judgment over that of editors, looking to fact check, or at the very least to seek a plurality of views. For media proprietors, this should be very concerning, because declining trust and diminishing authority equals a loss of public confidence and influence. Of course, this makes it especially important that public media continue not just to hold public figures and institutions to account, but to test and to scrutinise all arguments vigorously to see if they hold up. To be courageous and curious, not to be selectively sceptical, but to be widely so. To make all information available. Let all the partisan voices be heard, not just some. Because when they aren't, When views are not available from authoritative media, which are with assured standards of fairness and accuracy, people search elsewhere for it. They go to the blogosphere and other sources that have not passed the same tests, where information which might provide comfort rather than challenge might also be dubious, imprecise, and unreliable. Ideally, quality assurance measures might be the same for all media, yet they are not. However, public media must always strive for standards of comprehensiveness, accuracy, deferring to audiences rather than making decisions on their behalf. Journalistic authority should be based on presentation of the full range of views. In this way, we might ensure that when we ask who is the public expected to believe, the public broadcasters will be included in the answer. And amid all the partisan noise, the ABC's responsibility is enlarged. It must offer not the illusion of comprehensiveness, but the genuine article. The ABC Town Square must be authentically pure pluralist. Partisanship may affect editorial choices within other media, but the ABC must be dedicated to objectivity and impartiality, values whose usefulness to civic life have not been exhausted, values that many still believe in. The impression that powerful vested interests wield power over the media can be as easily gained by what is not reported as by what is. For instance, we were told in an article in the New Yorker magazine entitled "The Truth Wears Off, Is There Something Wrong with the Scientific Method?" that all sorts of well-established, multiply confirmed scientific findings have started to look uncertain. "It's as if our facts were losing their truth," says the author Jonah Lehrer. This phenomenon, known as the decline effect, is occurring across a wide range of fields, from psychology to ecology. His study shows that in many current scientific fields, claimed research findings may simply be accurate measures of the prevailing bias. Publication bias was thought to be mostly confined to clinical trials, since pharmaceutical companies are less interested in publishing results which aren't favourable. But it is now clear that publication bias produces major distortions in fields without large corporate incentives. Biologist Richard Palmer from the University of Alberta shares this view. He says scientists selectively report data and find ways to confirm their preferred hypothesis, disregarding what they don't want to see. Our beliefs are a sort of blindness, he said, and that once he realised how it was everywhere in science, he became quite depressed. Depressing indeed, but as Palmer explains, selective reporting is not the same as scientific fraud, but the result of subtle omissions and susceptibility to all sorts of perception biases. Perhaps, but the Wall Street Journal has recently reported an upsurge in retraction notices in scientific journals, including for fraud. As the journal noted, there is a lot to be gained by both researchers and journal editors to publish influential papers. The stakes are so high, the editor of Lancet told the journal, a single paper in Lancet and you get your chair, your money, and it's your passport to success. However, there is little transparency behind the retractions, suggesting a too cozy relationship between the editors of scientific journals and the scientific community. And it's no different in economics, where collective illusions also exist. World leaders, treasury officials, central bankers, Wall Street oligarchs, and the mainstream media seem more comfortable selling hope than they are confronting reality. And each time that they have inevitably been proven spectacularly wrong, a little more public faith and trust in these public figures and institutions has been lost. Sheltering the public from the truth or spinning the facts may temporarily save the hide of the political and financial insiders, but in doing so, unprepared and unsuspected general populace is exposed to the full forces of the orthodox narrative never foretold, And this does not go unnoticed, and it leads to feelings of betrayal. As Paul Kelly says, rarely has the gulf between the insider culture and the outsider perspective been greater. So why is it then that when the world's media has allowed So why is it that the world's media has allowed Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke, who speak with the authority and the backup that their office and positions confer, to get away with so many bad calls and so much wealth destruction? Why should they still be credible? Why should we listen to the Chairman Bernanke, who told us in June 2008 that in 2009 the US economy would return to trend growth and that it would not be a nationwide housing slump? Why should we believe Secretary Geithner, who told us there was no risk of a US ratings downgrade? Why should we believe the US Treasury projections today when in 2009 they said that this year's deficit would be would be $580 billion, when in fact it's nearly $1.5 trillion. I mean, what in the education of our media has failed to equip us with the means to question or scrutinise the authority of these views? Why is every solution a government solution? We may think we're all Keynesians now, but perhaps contemporary teachings of Keynes are not faithful to the original doctrine. Or maybe Keynes is now a defunct economist. Perhaps postmodernist economists have so captivated journalists that they have suspended the spirit of inquiry, open-mindedness and scrutiny that an informed democracy so desperately needs. Under relentless pressure, classical economics has all but become a relic of a bygone era. Yet the work of classical economics and classical economists most likely holds a solution to today's economic ills. But it would seem that many journalists have become subject to the same blindness that Richard Palmer has found in scientists. Maybe, too, they have become partial to their preferred theories and confirmatory bias. Is this groupthink which has gradually undermined the public's confidence? Of course, it is aided and abetted by the unremitting demands of the 24-hour news cycle. But whatever the reason, there is a widening estrangement between the public and the once trusted messenger, and this has been reflected in declining patronage. This disconnect is also due to journalists underestimating the independence and capacity of ordinary people to come to their own conclusions. The public may not always be right, nor will it always understand the high-minded esoterics of the argument, but it will weigh the evidence and it will decide for itself. In this world of uncertainty of knowing who to trust, I believe the ABC is wonderfully placed to pursue pluralism with increased enthusiasm and authority so that we accommodate as many voices as are readily available to us. It's a way, too, of dealing with the increasing intellectual and academic hostility towards the value of the values of objectivity and impartiality. Tom Switzer said recently, "These days, journalistic objectivity is a misnomer, both here and abroad, for every story involves subjective judgments, especially in the digital age." Professor J. Rosen has said that people are more likely to trust you if they know where you're coming from. Now, while Australia has successfully resisted importing some of the excesses peculiar to the British media that I spoke of earlier, I feel less certain about the influences at present from the United States, where there may be scepticism of journalism academics about traditional journalistic values or the partisanship of the journalists. Indeed, it is my personal view of our schools of journalism, based on my talks with academics, reading what many of them say and write, as well as speaking to their students, that they are preparing future journalists to be partisans, not to be pluralists. And this is unhelpful to future employers who are looking for people with a broader education and may lead to more journalists being employed from a non-media background. But let me turn back to the ABC. As the chairman of a taxpayer-funded national broadcaster, I realise that I may be criticised as someone who is sheltered from the cut and thrust of day-to-day commercial life. Let me assure you, I am well acquainted with the cut and thrust of commercial life, but perhaps not having to answer to shareholders every 6 months allows me the luxury of reflection and distance that pursuing profits may preclude. And while the ABC is fortunate to still rate highly on the trust factor, we are not immune, nor should we be, from public scrutiny. Like everyone else in the media business, we must honour the compact we have with our audiences. Once lost, trust may never be recovered, which is why I care so much about our performance. It is also why I take only moderate comfort from the validation of our relatively stronger position in the surveys. If the total pool is diminishing credibility, we are all affected, no less the ABC. But it is an opportunity for us to improve our quality, distinctiveness and originality in the quest to provide a better, more valued service for all Australians. I will always remain a friend of the ABC, in the truest sense of that word, and I've offered my observation in the spirit of that friendship, and I'd like to think that they will be interpreted in that light. Our lives begin to end, said Martin Luther King, the day we become silent about things that matter. I came here tonight to the Sydney Institute while I'm still chairman of the ABC because I did not want to remain silent, but to talk about some of those things that matter deeply to me now than to wait until after I had left this great public institution that I have had the enormous privilege to chair for the past 5 years. I remain encouraged that at the end of the day and at the end of my 5 years, we continue to command not just the attention and loyalty, but most importantly, the faith and confidence of so many Australians. In everything the ABC does, long after I have departed, may it always remember and cherish that trust. Partisanship may well become the dominant model within the media in years to come. Yet by our insistence on maintaining a public pluralist presence, pluralism itself will ultimately prevail. Thank you.
Many thanks to Maurice Newman for an important speech. Thanks also to Clayton Utz for the use of this facility this evening. And so we come to question and discussion period, and we'll end no later than 7 o'clock. Once upon a time we used to live lives, but now we engage in personal journeys. So your personal journey, I first learnt of you when you did the eminently sensible act of, as I recall, financing Milton Friedman to come out to Australia to talk about economics at the time of the mayhem of the around the 1974 budget, the Whitlam government years, and that had quite a big impact on the public debate. And he was heard on the ABC and elsewhere. Chairman and boards don't run organisations, public or private, but you these days, 40 years later, you, as a person from the private sector, you go down to Canberra and you ask governments for whole lots of taxpayers' money, and you've done it very successfully. You've scored a lot of government money for the ABC, which wasn't there before you arrived. As the other cliche goes, how do you feel about that? You come up and speak to the end of the...
Well, it's a good question, Jared, and if you posed it before.
But not for you to respond.
But the fact is that if you accept the role of chairman of the ABC, then you accept the responsibilities which go with that. I think the ABC is an important institution, and it obviously has to be funded to be able to do what it does. And so I understand the inherent inconsistency between free markets and government-funded public broadcasters. But I think there is a need for a public broadcaster at this time. Maybe over time we will evolve to a point where the need for a public broadcaster no longer remains, and people will argue that some of the activities of public broadcasters in metropolitan areas has passed us by, and that this is quite well catered for by the private sector. So that is a legitimate case, but I still believe in the role of the ABC, and as I say, if I take on the responsibility of chairing it, that also carries the responsibility of ensuring that it can conduct its affairs properly and without having to worry about where its next dollar is coming from.
Nick, and then Lindsay.
Yes, thanks, Ben. That was a great talk. During the talk, you outlined the risks of selectivity and of groupthink in various aspects of the media, in science and in the press. I guess the question is, do you feel that the average ABC journalist accepts that perspective, and do they think that they're guilty of groupthink? This is one of the great debates which I know you've commented on before.
Well, I think increasingly there is diversity. I should have actually had a different title for my speech. But I think there is a growing diversity within the ABC. I mean, the ABC actually does work at impartiality and balance. We don't always get it right, and we've acknowledged that. I think Mark Scott acknowledged that when he was here. We have editorial policies which are in place to ensure and to hold people to that we do comply with our charter, and that our journalists and presenters also comply. But we haven't got it right. I was asked last night at a function where I was also a speaker at Macquarie University whether under my chairmanship the ABC had moved to the right. I said I was unable to answer that because my inbox is generally reasonably balanced, depending on the program we put to air, from both sides as far as criticism is concerned. But I don't hide from the fact that we haven't got it right and that we have to do more. It's work in progress. And I'm sure that my successor will also carry on the task of holding everyone to account.
Go to Lindsay, then we go to Richard. Yep.
I want to follow on the previous question and your comments about bias and partisanship, and indeed Jared has written about that. And as a matter of practical reality, what can the board do after 5 years and longer as a member? What should the board do? And continuing your previous answer, what has the board done? And indeed, can the board do anything? Does the board make a difference when it comes to these matters of bias and partisanship?
I think the board does and has made a difference. We have drafted a whole new editorial policy structure. We are being much more rigorous in holding people accountable. But this is work in progress. You don't sort of start today with a whole new regime and find you get the results that you want. And the board, of course, has to rely upon management to achieve the results. So it's management that is ultimately accountable to the board, and it is for the board to hold management to account. But as I said in my earlier response, that we haven't got it right. It is work in progress. The progress is too slow for some. But nevertheless, it is something which is cultural and requires a cultural change, and culture takes a long time to change. But I think that we are making progress. And I would say, because I preface my remarks, that what I had to say wasn't about the ABC, it was about media in general. I do think that the ABC is more rigorous when it comes to prosecuting its editorial policies than many other media outlets. Some of them, of course, are quite happy to pursue the partisan line, and that's for them, that's a commercial decision which they take. But that is not a luxury which is open to us. We really do have to observe the requirements of our charter, and that's what we endeavour to do.
My question really follows on the previous two questions, and as you spoke, I thought about the 7:30 report and 7:30, and it suddenly made me think that I saw definite progress from the way Kerry O'Brien would the perception of his position and interviews, and Chris Yeoman's position. And I think that might be an example that made me sort of qualify my question a little. But then when I think about programs like Insiders and Q&A, and then compare it to Andrew Bolt, I see that the ABC, in my perception, and I believe it's a widely held perception, is much more in the Age and Fairfax left-wing perception of media reporting. And I just wonder, particularly what you said about the board and management's responsibility, how the board actually works with management and set standards for management, because we all know if a manager doesn't succeed in doing what the board has agreed will be, as I think you were emphasising, a disinterested and objective way of reporting, there'll be consequences. Where's it going?
Well, the board receives reports from management where there have been breaches, and the board notes those, and management is told on occasions where we need to pull up our socks. But I think, as you say, I think that there is progress, and very often, I mean, bias is very much in the eye of the beholder. Last night there was somebody, as I said to you, who said, since I've been the chair, the organisation has moved to the right. Now, I have no idea why that person believes that, but presumably it deals with where they thought our starting point was, and if it has moved from where they thought it was, at least whether that's in the right direction or the wrong direction, it's moved. But as I said, it's not a luxury that we have as a public broadcaster, paid for by all taxpayers, not just 10% or 20% of them. And that's why pluralism is so important in the delivery of what we do.
Robin Williams.
Two quick statements and a question. First of all, I applaud your use of the word media to applaud. Secondly, I've got, in 2 weeks and 3 weeks' time, some broadcasts confirming what you say about the uncertainty in science. Amazing examples. The question is based on the fact that when Greenpeace raided the CSIRO wheat field and destroyed it, I broadcast a professor from Adelaide criticising what they'd done with evidence. They demanded a right of reply, and I said no, because they'd been on the ABC elsewhere anyway, and I didn't see why I should give them a platform in the course of breaking the law. And I said, you are a lobby. And similarly with other lobbies like the IPA, for scientists from the IPA, for the second or third time demands a platform, we say, no, we're supposed to be about new evidence. I wonder how much you are concerned about the rise of lobbies in thwarting the pluralism you speak of.
Well, I think it's well put. Clearly there is a rise in lobbyists, and when you see people being quoted in the media as independent, if you dig a little deeper, you'll find that they're being funded from one side of the argument or the other. But it's people, particularly today, are constantly fighting to get airtime or space in newspapers in order to put forward their point of view, because they believe that will influence the opinions of those who they want to reach. How successful they are with that remains to be seen, because, as I said, it is important, and that's why the ABC, I think, is important, that we've been able to maintain the trust of the people. But you have to say, as any organisation, if you begin to lose the trust and respect of people, you lose influence, and you lose authority, and you lose credibility. So you may be saying things that have very little resonance with those people, because maybe many of them don't even read it.
Anne, and then we'll go to John. Yep.
A week or so ago, we heard from Jonathan Mills from Edinburgh, who's the director of the Edinburgh Festival. He had a powerful paper on ABC and its charter. He was coming from the perspective that the current ABC is increasingly favouring current affairs, the sort of entertainment through happenings today, whatever, and that it has lost its way in terms of the way in which it used to encourage artists, bring on young, talented musicians. And I've heard this from other people who belong in the arts field. Do you think we've gone a bit too far, the 24-hour news idea, and we maybe should bring back more of that, that fostering of the creativity that is in music, science, the arts, all of that? Because I do think the ABC, as a public broadcaster, should be much more into that boat.
Well, first of all, that's an opinion that he's entitled to hold. I don't entirely agree with that. I think that what we're trying to do now is to, in fact, rejuvenate our efforts in relation to the arts. We do encourage, particularly through Triple J and through other means, young musicians. They may not be the sort of music that you and I listen to, but it's been amazing how successful some of those young people have been, having had a start there. Whether or not the ABC should do all of these things itself, it isn't really to do with the 24-hour news presentations. While that's often used as a reason as to why we've had some change in direction, the change in direction is because we think we can produce better results by enlisting independent producers as well as doing in-house productions, so that at the end of the day, what we are able to put to air and the opportunities for Australian artists will not be reduced but enhanced.
John?
Yes, sir. On particularly rating on national broadcasting programs on the ABC One, you see a lot of BBC product, and some of it's good, some of it's not so good, and some of it's even in prime time. And certainly when I've gone through Asia and the Pacific, you see some Australian ABC programs being presented in other countries. What's the best model for the development of quality ABC programs that can be produced and delivered overseas? And what's the BBC doing that's so good that we've got to see so much of it?
Well, there's a definite demand for BBC programs in Australia. They play very well, and it's not just the ABC. I think Channel 7, Channel 9 have bought a plethora of programs from the BBC. And pay TV. And well, that is BBC, of course, on Fox with Lifestyle and the BBC itself. But there is a demand here. And let's face it, they do it very well. And they also have a budget which is somewhat larger than we have. And so it's possible for us to buy quality programs that we can put to air at prices that we couldn't possibly recreate or that we could replicate if we were paying for it ourselves. I'm somewhat restricted in what I can say about our international services because that's currently been in the government's hands to determine a contract. But I can certainly say that what we have done in the past is to provide programs that capture not just what the ABC produces, but also what some of our commercial peers produce, and we put that to air, which is a means of presenting Australia's culture and values and the way of life to those people who reside in other places. And it's not just through Australian Network, it's done through Radio Australia. Radio Australia is just amazing in its reach. And what we're finding through word of mouth, that there's a tremendous demand for what we're doing with Radio Australia. And it's not just through the conventional shortwave, medium wave, and the conventional means of broadcasting. We're also now doing it across the web through new media, but through using the internet intelligently, through using things like Facebook. I mean, it became a great surprise to me to find in researching the speech which I did last night, which would be a good trivia quiz for you if you go to dinner sometime, the second most actively used Facebook nation in the world is Indonesia, with over 88 million users of Facebook, second only to the United States, which has got 100 and something million users. Now, you know, I think if you were to ask that question, Indonesia are probably about 100th on your list. But it just shows you that these developments are taking place in the world out there we probably are not aware of. And I think that one of the things which we are able to do with the ABC, because it is an innovative organisation, is to exploit some of those opportunities with a high rate of success.
Probably the final question here. Yeah.
the ABC's recently had some competition with the Australian Network in Asia. The government's gone a bit too far with the competition.
I think that's probably a question that the chairman can't
answer. Yeah, I haven't quite finished it yet. But I'm asking for is do you feel that competition is good in this respect? I'm not asking for an opinion as to what.
Yeah, I think that's too close to the bone.
I'll try you one that isn't, or shouldn't be. I mean, as I said earlier, you've been very successful, but you're not the manager, obviously, but in recent times the ABC has appeared to have moved into areas that it wasn't in previously, like online opinion, for example. I mean, opinion used to be places essentially for newspapers, but now, effectively, you're running an online version of print on the Drum and the Drum Online and those kind of things, and you've moved into other areas. I mean, as you know, you've spoken about Britain. In Britain, the BBC is retreating a bit because there's a feeling that there's an unfair competition of a public entity funded by the taxpayer moving into what were private areas. This has happened a bit in Australia, not perhaps as much as in Britain. I mean, are you feeling pressure from the commercial interest there, and do you think they have some kind of a cause?
I'm sure they would think they have a cause. My personal view is that the BBC is under a great deal of financial pressure, which is why it's pulling back in areas where it thinks it can do so without a great deal of disruption to the organisation. But the internet and new media or using technology such as iView, which is not what you're talking about, but we're talking about the Drum and the. And I can see the point that it can be construed as being a sort of an electronic newspaper. But there is a need for that and a demand for that. And so we are satisfying and catering to that demand. And I know we're running short of time, but I was struck when I was in Japan not long ago that NHK runs games programs. These are very successful games programs. They have tremendous audiences. I don't believe that is a legitimate activity for a public broadcaster. I think that can easily be catered for by the private sector. I'm sure it helps to secure additional funding for NHK in Japan. But if that was to come to me as the chairman of the ABC, I would be very much opposed to us being involved with that.
Many thanks.
Thanks.
As you recall, Maurice Newman was appointed chairman of the ABC by the Howard Coalition government, but his appointment at the time was welcomed by Stephen Conroy, the then Shadow Minister for Communications, and I think it's fair to say that Maurice Newman has been an excellent chairman of the ABC, certainly the best in my memory. So we're delighted that he could come along tonight, which is towards the end of his term, and talk about the ABC, but also about the media in general, and of course a lot of the points in the speech tonight related to the media in general, some of it related to the commercial media, some of it related to the public sector media. So it's great you're here tonight. Your talk will be on our podcast tomorrow. Paper will be published in the Sydney Papers online as a permanent record of your talk here tonight, but well done and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, folks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.